This is Full-Time Catholic Radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit.
A good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. Thanks for joining me on this Friday. I'm going to talk a little bit at the beginning of today's program about St. Elizabeth of the Trinity, a remarkable woman, died at the age of 26, I believe. She was a Carmelite and gave us a very accessible vision of the contemplative life and contemplation of the indwelling Christ. We'll talk about in a few minutes here. Also today, we're going to look at the question of gender ideology in the second hour. I was glad to be part of the Catholic Men's Movement Thursday meeting last night at Christ the King, where Dr. Dan Keating spoke on gender ideology. And I want to share some of the points that he made and some further reflections of my own. We're also going to talk today with Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione, who is going to reflect on truth and beauty and the upcoming Mass of the Americas on November 16th. We want to keep that out in front of us because this is, I'm hoping, will be a significant launch of a new movement to unify Catholics across borders. So that's coming up in this first hour in about 20 minutes. We're also going to talk about suicide and spiritual warfare. My guest, Teresa Anthony, will share her own experience of losing a loved one to suicide, her son Matthew, and also the spiritual warfare that she noted going on in their family's life. And we'll also talk to Matthew Bunsen about next week's U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops meeting in Baltimore. It's their annual fall meeting. There's much to talk about there. We'll talk about also the ad limina visits that the U.S. bishops are on. This happens, it's supposed to happen every 5 years. But first, let's get to today's headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Friday, November 8th. It's the Feast of St. Elizabeth of the Trinity. Today's news is brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need. Learn more at visitingangels.com. President Trump is denying reports that he agreed to drop tariffs on China. Trump saying today he hasn't agreed to anything, but noted that China would, quote, like to have a rollback. The comments dampened hopes of the world's two biggest economic powers were closer to a trade deal. The U.S. and China have been working on phase one of a trade agreement to be signed by Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping in the coming weeks. Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney didn't show up for his deposition in the impeachment inquiry against President Trump. His attorney sent a notice to lawmakers 1 minute before Mulvaney was scheduled to testify, saying that he was acting on President Trump's orders and that he had, quote, absolute immunity. The House is unlikely to go to court to force Mulvaney to testify. Germany is commemorating the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Here's correspondent Bill Zimpfer taking a look back.
The surprise announcement came on November 9, 1989, that checkpoints would be opened, allowing free passage between East and West Berlin. At first, East Berlin residents were skeptical, but found that the crossings were indeed open for the first time in 28 years. During that time, anyone trying to flee East Berlin for the West would be shot. It wouldn't be long before people appeared with sledgehammers and picks to pound away at the wall, leading to the wall coming down and the reunification of Germany about a year later. Bill Zimpfer, NBC News Radio.
The CDC is pointing to a vitamin E synthetic as the likely cause behind the 39 vaping-related deaths in the U.S. Vitamin E acetate was discovered in the lung fluids of 29 people who became ill during the outbreak. The CDC reports more than 2,000 people have become ill in the outbreak. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Today is the Feast of St. Elizabeth of the Trinity. Probably not in some ways, if you're interested in contemplative side of Catholicism, you may be well aware of Elizabeth the Trinity, but I would say that a good number of us are not that familiar with her. Carolyn Humphreys, who's a secular, discalced Carmelite, has written an outstanding biography called From Ashes to Fire, An Odyssey in Prayer, about Elizabeth the Trinity, looking at her life and her message, her teaching. And I've had an opportunity to see portions of it. I haven't read the whole thing. but it's one of those books on saints that I especially like because it's not, you know, it's not bleeding excessive piety. Some books on the saints are just hard to take, at least from my perspective. This is a much stronger look at the really the person of Elizabeth of the Trinity. So, for instance, I'll give you an example here. She died, by the way, at the age of 26, so she did not live long. But during her infancy, she's described as an incessant chatterbox and vivacious crawler. She knew what she wanted and went after it. Her only sibling was born in 1883. Her name was Margaret, nicknamed, looks like, Gweet. Elizabeth was fondly called Sabbath. The sisters were as different as night and day. Gweet was gentle. Sabbath went into rages. Today, Elizabeth would be called a brat. At that time, she was called the little captain. Her dad died 2 years later, and, you know, just was really, really troubled the family. We know that they had to live as a mother and two daughters. They grew very close together as a result of that. They had to move after the death of the father, but Elizabeth continued her education. Her primary subject, in fact, was music, and apparently she excelled at it. But she still maintained not only a strong will, but a furious temper. She was subject to rages. And this caused her mother at one point to threaten to send her to the House of Corrections that were run by the Good Shepherd Sisters. So, it's pointed out, Carolyn actually points out here, that the mother and sister even packed her suitcases to ship her off. The key thing is that Elizabeth was always contrite. And this is the difference between saints and sinners, isn't it? I mean, we always say that saints have a past and the sinners have a future. Elizabeth, and what makes the difference is that willing to switch from defiance, rebellion, persistence in one's corrupt will and desires, and switch to, Lord, forgive me, I am a sinner. And so she had that ability to pivot from her rages to her lamentation. And she was persistent. Her parish priest said that she would be a saint or a demon by the end of her life. Thankfully, she was a saint. When she was 14, her teacher asked the class to write a composition describing a self-portrait. And Elizabeth wrote about herself, "To draw one's physical and moral portrait is a delicate subject to deal with. But taking my courage in both hands, I set to work and began. Without pride, I think I can say that my overall appearance is not displeasing. I'm a brunette, and they say rather tall for my age. I have sparkling black eyes, and my thick eyebrows give me a severe look. The rest of my person is insignificant. My, quote, dainty feet could win for me the nickname of Elizabeth the Bigfoot, like Queen Bertha. And there you have my physical portrait. As for my moral portrait, I would say that I have a rather good character. I'm cheerful, and I must confess, somewhat scatterbrained. I have a good heart. I am by nature a coquette. One should be a little, they say. I'm not lazy. I know work makes us happy. Without being a model of patience, I usually know how to control myself. I do not hold grudges. So much for my moral portrait. I have my defects and, alas, few good qualities. I hope to acquire them. Well, at least this tedious task is finished, and I'm glad." Two topics aren't mentioned in that little portrait. She had already won first prize at piano at the conservatory that year, and she says nothing about her musical talent. In fact, she received thunderous applause after her performance. And she was regarded already as a distinguished pianist, an excellent touch, beautiful tone. And the second point in that portrait is she doesn't mention her spiritual life. Now, this is, to me, surprising. she writes about it in her personal notes. She writes poetry that describes her spiritual life. But she's still, again, in early, still early adolescence there. And she's not writing about it when she comes up with her spiritual, with her physical and moral portrait. She does grow in awareness of the presence of God within her as she gets older. She wants to be a Carmelite. She accepts her mother's wishes to wait until she's 21 before entering. And there she spends the time. She has sewing lessons. She loves beautiful clothes. She wore the latest hairstyles. She made many trips with her sister and mother and loved the mountains, loved nature. She spent a lot of time outside. She had friends, parties, fine dining, played tennis and croquet, participated in impromptu music sessions. Although she did not speak of God, he radiated from her so vividly. This is what Carolyn writes. Although she did not speak of God, he radiated from her so vividly that perceptive people at these gala occasions could not help but notice. We do know that the 2 years before she entered Carmel, she lived a pretty sound spiritual life. She didn't make a show of her devotions. She did do the corporal works of mercy, but she didn't make a show of it. She had a spiritual maturity, and she was already engaged in contemplative prayer. And one of the things from Elizabeth of the Trinity that we learn is that being a contemplative depends more on our interior receptivity to God than on our external environment or any kind of canonical legislation. She was charming. She was easily lovable. She had several suitors who wanted her hand in marriage. Her mother did not encourage Elizabeth's Carmelite vocation. She actually wanted her to marry and went and found what she thought was the perfect husband for Elizabeth. But they were unable to change Elizabeth's mind. She decided she was going to become a contemplative sister at Carmel. She entered Carmel when she's at 21 years old. She makes her final vows. Her health begins to deteriorate fairly soon afterwards, and she's dead of Addison's disease at the age of 26. Now, I think you think of 26-year-olds today and you really wonder how Elizabeth, at 26 years old, could have had the interior maturity that she did. Her writings are really very beautiful. She says, "I found my heaven on earth. Since heaven is God and God is in my soul, I have found my heaven on earth." That's the sense she had of, in contemplative prayer, of being able to dwell with God. And she really encourages us to reflect on Mary's life, the Annunciation, the Nativity. This gives us concrete evidence of how to understand the indwelling presence of God. And Elizabeth's concept of God was extremely personal. None of this this idea of the impersonal one, and she was also, unlike most of Catholics of her day, even those in religious life, she was a very strong student of Scripture. She personalized the text. And she, you don't have to be a scholar to love Scripture, and she loved Scripture. She did Lectio Divina. She prayerfully and reflectively read the Gospels. She loved St. Paul, and she was very intuitive in understanding the theology of St. Paul. I do want to mention one thing in particular, though. It's what's been called her act of oblation. And I'm going to read it to you, because I do think the beauty of it opens a window on her soul. So here, she penned this act of oblation when she was, again, in Carmel. O eternal Word, Word of my God, I want to spend my life in listening to you, to become wholly teachable that I may learn all from you. Through all nights, all voids, all helplessnesses, I want to gaze on you always and remain in your great light. O my three, my all, my beatitude, infinite solitude, immensity in which I lose myself, I surrender myself to you as your prey. P-R-E-Y, by the way. As your prey. Bury yourself in me that I may bury myself in you until I depart to contemplate in your light the abyss of your greatness. End of quote. And then Carolyn Humphreys penned this brief overview of Elizabeth of the Trinity. And this is taken from her work that Ignatius Press published. It's called From Ashes to Fire, an Odyssey in Prayer. And it's a look at the life and the message, the spirituality, I guess, of St. Elizabeth of the Trinity. Again, she lived only 26 years, and she encapsulated the Carmelite attributes of reflective prayer, living in the present moment, loving God wholeheartedly, serving others with simplicity. She described her vision of a Carmelite as one who, quote, has beheld the crucified, who has seen him offering himself to the Father as a victim for souls, and meditating in the light of this great vision of Christ's charity, has understood the passion of love that filled his soul, and has willed to give himself as he did. With the help of grace, she said, we can live with in intimacy with God and service to others. And this, I think, is her most characteristic prayer. She wanted us all to be aware of the Trinitarian dwelling place, the little heaven, as she put it, within each of our souls. That's where our intimacy with God can grow, and she encourages us to quietly radiate that Trinitarian presence wherever we are. So again, the dwelling place, the little heaven, where we encounter God in our souls.
It took 2 stressful years to settle my mother's disorganized estate. We wanted to save our children the headaches created by poor estate planning. We called Jason Negri.
Jason is an estate planning attorney with expertise on end-of-life issues from a Catholic perspective.
He prepared all our documents, and he addressed our concerns regarding end-of-life medical care. We were highly satisfied with the personal service we received from Jason.
Visit JasonNegri.com today. That's JasonNegri.com.
You don't think it'll happen to you twice. First, it was a fire. That agent was right there and helped me rebuild. Then the tornado destroyed everything again. Both times, my independent agent and auto owners took care of me like someone takes care of family.
For whatever lies ahead, we're always there. Auto Owners Insurance.
For your no-obligation quote, please call Choice Insurance at 734-641-4200.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
Stress is contagious, even for toddlers. A new study by the University of Cambridge found that even after controlling for temperament, the more stressed moms and dads felt, the more their toddlers tended to be clingy, tantruming, whiny, and defiant. In general, kids are terrific emotional barometers. Little ones especially are always taking their emotional cues from us, even when we think we're keeping it to ourselves. Parents' stress plays out in our facial expressions, our posture, our attitudes, and our ability to pay attention, all things our kids attend to closely. When our kids notice us feeling stressed, it makes them feel unsafe and causes them to act out. If your little one seems off, a good first step is asking yourself how you're managing your own stress level. An ounce of self-care can sometimes be worth a pound of discipline. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
They call it good customer service, but really it's Christ service. You know, the golden rule, do unto others as you would do unto yourself. Customer service is about being Christ-like. As a communications professional, I often get these newsletters or surveys about customer service. I often write similar ones myself to my own clients about how to communicate effectively with your customer base. But it's really simple. It's, after all, being respectful of a person's time, feelings, business, and needs. If someone hires you to do a service or provide a product, he or she expects you to deliver. And if you cannot, on time or at all, be honest about it. Wouldn't Jesus expect us to do what we say we're going to do, admit when we're wrong, work out our conflicts respectfully? He certainly would not want us to burn a bridge. I mean, you just might have to cross over it one day. This has been a Christ-Centered Communication message. I'm Vanessa Dunha-Garmo, a communications evangelist.
How can you teach your children to live their pro-life mission beyond the walls of your home or parish? One way is to engage your family's values in pro-life Catholic healthcare options, like CMF Curo. CMF Curo is rooted in the Church's teachings on life and family and offers affordable healthcare sharing options that can save you and your family thousands. Learn more about the CMF Curo Catholic healthcare community and find healthcare options at mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com.
In hundreds of counties in Appalachia in the South, there is no Catholic presence. There are no priests, brothers, sisters, or lay ministers. The less than 1% of the population that is Catholic often struggles to participate in the life of the Church. Glen Mary Home Missioners is the only Catholic community exclusively committed to serving this part of the United States. To learn more about joining Glen Mary Home Missioners in this mission, visit glenmary.org. That's glenmary.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Maggie Gallagher joined us to talk about the work of the Benedict XVI Institute on Sacred Music and Worship, which is an outgrowth of the encouragement of Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione, Archbishop of San Francisco. And we talked specifically about the upcoming Mass of the America. And I wanted to talk with the Archbishop about the work of the Benedict XVI Institute on Sacred Music and Worship, and specifically about this upcoming event on the Mass of the Americas. Archbishop Cordiglione is the Archbishop of San Francisco, ordained a priest in 1982, served for 7 years in Rome as an assistant at the Supreme Tribunal of the Apostolic Signatura, the Church's highest canonical court. He was appointed an auxiliary bishop of the Diocese of San Diego in 2002, and then Bishop of Oakland in 2009, appointed Archbishop of San Francisco in 2012. And he also sits on the USCCB's Committee for Canonical Affairs and Church Governance. And this month, he will assume the role as chairman of the Committee on Laity, Marriage, Family Life, and Youth. And, Your Excellency, it's good to talk with you again. It's been quite a long time.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Let's talk a little bit about the Benedict XVI Institute on Sacred Music and Worship. Tell me about the origins of it.
The origins come about out of a vision to provide parishes with resources to enhance their liturgical celebrations for more reverent and more beautiful masses that will really inspire people and attract them and with the joy of participating in divine worship. And it we do that, but the vision is expanded as well. So we provide those resources, especially with on the music side of it, with the teaching choir to help parish choirs and school choirs learn how to sing the sacred music. But we're also committed to revitalizing a Catholic culture of the arts. The Church has always been the great patron of the arts.
Right.
And I think we probably haven't been paying that much attention to it for quite some time now. The Church has given the world so much through beauty, you know, and I think we need to open that door wider. And so we're trying to revitalize this Catholic culture of the arts by featuring the work of Catholic artists and by a lecture series and also by commissioning new masses such as the Mass of the Americas that we'll be celebrating in Washington, D.C. at the National Shrine on November 16th.
Why is it called the Mass of the Americas?
Yes, well, you had mentioned about last year when December 8th fell on a Saturday in the Archdiocese of San Francisco. We have this Guadalupana March every year, the Saturday before the feast day, December 12th.
Mm-hmm.
It begins early in the morning at 6 o'clock in the morning with a 12-mile procession. It ends at the cathedral at 2 o'clock, and then this one of the largest masses of the whole year is the mass that's celebrated then. I noticed last year that day would be on December 8th, so we would be celebrating the solemnity of the Immaculate Conception. She's the patroness of the United States. On this occasion of the Cruzada Guadalupana and its 25th anniversary, honoring Our Lady of Guadalupe, the patroness of Mexico and all of the Americas. So the thought occurred to me that we need to seize that opportunity to hold up Our Lady as the mother who unites all of God's children in one family. We all love our Blessed Mother. She has so many titles. She's appeared in so many places. And she's our mother.
Yes.
And a mother wants her children together, united in one family. So I thought we needed to seize that opportunity. So I got the idea to ask the composer of the Mass, who's quite an accomplished composer of sacred music, who lives here locally in the Bay Area, Frank LaRocca, to compose this Mass of a new composition of sacred music, but incorporating the sounds and even some of the melodies of the popular songs the Mexican people sing to honor Our Lady of Guadalupe. So it's the music itself and the Mass itself it conveys this theme of us being one integral family of God. So the comparison I gave to guide him was what the Franciscan missionaries did in California a couple of hundred years ago with the mission church architecture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? A mission church, it's a classic Catholic church, there's no doubt about that. But it also reflects the local culture.
Yes.
By the building materials that are used and the style of art that's come from it. So it reflects the local culture, but it incorporates it in a sacred sense. So I asked him to do that with the music, and what he produced it actually accomplishes exactly that. It's quite a beautiful Mass. It's a new composition of sacred music. It's
yeah.
very sacred, but it also has the feeling of the local culture that's incorporated into it. And then we got the idea to take it on the road. We call it a Marian Unity Tour.
Yes.
Celebrate it in different places. And in fact, it has been celebrated already another time. And this was actually in the Archdiocese of Tijuana, where the Archbishop there, who's quite an accomplished musician himself, was hosting a National Congress of Liturgical Music.
Wow.
And he asked that it be the concluding Mass for that National Congress. So I was there. The singers and musicians came from the American side of the border, and there were people prominent in church music from all over Mexico there at the same time. So that was the second time it was celebrated. Now we'll be celebrating it at the National Shrine in Washington, D.C. on November 16th. And this time it was suggested to me to celebrate this in an extraordinary form style of Mass. So it will be a solemn high pontifical Mass in the extraordinary form, but again, with the same music. Now, Frank had to make some adaptations with the music to make it suitable to a traditional Mass.
Mm-hmm.
But it will be the same music and the same vestments. A special set of vestments was commissioned for this Mass as well that incorporates the themes of the apparition of Our Lady at Tepeyac. And so, again, to show a sense of unity also in the Church's worship and a sense of continuity with the beauty the Church has given us, in continuity with the Church's worship. So we're making a whole day out of this. The Mass begins at 10 o'clock at the Shrine. In the afternoon, we're having a conference on sacred beauty, beginning with the panel discussion about the Mass itself. Then we'll have some breakout sessions. Richard Sparks, the conductor,
mm-hmm.
will have one on conducting. And the artist, Andrew Dessau, will have another one. And the poet and Villanova professor, James Matthew Wilson, will have one on literature.
Beautiful.
And poetry. And he's quite accomplished. Dana Gioia, he's
yep.
the California Poet Laureate, has described him as the future of Catholic letters in America.
Yep.
And we asked him to write a poem about this Mass, and he actually wrote a whole series of song cycles and published it in a book, and we'll have a book signing as well called The River of the Immaculate Conception.
Beautiful.
So it's an opportunity to, again, open this door of beauty. You know, the Church has always understood the importance of truth, beauty, and goodness as paths to the encounter with the divine. And the Church has always been prominent in the area of goodness, serving the poor, works of advocating for justice, works of charity, reaching out to the marginalized. The Church is still the largest private provider of social services and a private provider of health care in the United States. You know, with truth, how the Church has always been leading in the area of scientific research throughout history,
right.
as well as new catechetical resources. So I think those doors are, truth is opening wider, that door. Goodness has always been wide open. The door of beauty has not been so wide
right.
open, I don't
right.
think, in the last 50 years or so. So we're trying to open that wide because different people will connect with different ones. Some people read themselves into the Church. They walk through the door of truth. Other people encounter the loving care of Catholics serving the poor, and they come through the door of goodness. other people will be drawn to the door of beauty, and we need to keep that door wide open as well.
Amen. I think that's wonderful to hear. What is it that it sounds like this is a really thoroughly thought through way of enculturating the teaching of the church and the liturgy of the church. Why has the word enculturation gotten a bad name over the last generation?
I think it has because of a misappropriation of what that means. The church is always enculturated.
Right.
I mean, that was the vision of the Franciscan missionaries who came to this part of the world 500 years ago to build a new Christian civilization. Right. And
mm-hmm.
if we look at where they got started early and had more sort of social infrastructure to begin with in parts of Mexico and South America, Central America, we can see, I mentioned about the mission church architecture here. There was so much of more of that going on earlier on in those other parts of in the Americas. And so this new sort of Christian civilization has evolved. It wasn't a matter of just incorporating wholesale what it found in the local culture that it encountered, but taking what was good from it and sort of baptizing it, bringing it into the sacred. This is what the church has always done. I can think of when I visited India, I saw how the faith was enculturated there. This
mm-hmm.
takes centuries, really, to
right.
accomplish. I think we got the misappropriated idea of enculturation much more recently as just taking what is in the secular culture and then having it done that way, you know, within
yeah.
the context of divine worship.
Yeah.
And that's not really a proper sense of enculturation. That's just sort of aping what's in the secular culture
right.
rather than baptizing it, sacralizing it, and incorporating it within the sacred, which is what elevates the soul and leads to that encounter with the divine.
Could you do us a favor here and just explain why liturgical garments are so important? I think many people get music, right, because they listen and they sing. They don't necessarily get vestments. What's the theology behind vestments?
It's all connected with how the church understands that we teach more powerfully through symbols, really, than with words. Symbols speak more powerfully, and the vestments all have some symbolic value. Of course, they trace back to the attire of people in the ancient world, but over time became sort of stylized to have focus on the symbolic meaning of it. So the stole that the priest wears over his shoulders, or the deacon from one left shoulder to his right side, symbolizes the authority of the office. The chasuble, the poncho-like garment the priest wears over his alb and his stole, it symbolizes the charity of Christ. And there are prayers that the priest says when he puts on each of these vestments,
mm-hmm.
which indicates the symbolic meaning that it has. So St. Paul tells us when he speaks about all of the virtues, he said, over all these things put on love, that is the charity of Christ. And so we don't put anything over the chasuble because we're supposed to cover everything
yeah.
with the love of Christ.
Yeah.
The alb, the white garment, symbolizes that white baptismal gown that the newly baptized receives, putting on Christ and this new life of purity. So they all have these symbolic meanings to remind us of our Christian dignity and our call to live in conformity with that dignity.
Beautiful. Archbishop, thank you for taking the time to be with us today. This is very helpful, and we'll continue to promote the upcoming Mass of the Americas. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Ann Arbor Smiles welcomes Dr. Patrick DiDonato and Dr. Abigail Walker to their team. Patrick is a parishioner of St. Thomas the Apostle in Ann Arbor, and Abigail is a pediatric dentist with openings available without a wait. Learn more about them at AnnArborSmiles.com. The team at Ann Arbor Smiles offers nearly every specialty in two convenient locations, including cosmetic dentistry, braces and Invisalign, and even sleep apnea. Ann Arbor Smiles provides care for the entire family. Visit AnnArborSmiles.com.
You don't think it'll happen to you twice. First, it was a fire. My agent was right there and helped me rebuild. Then the tornado destroyed everything again. Both times, my independent agent and auto owners took care of me like someone takes care of family.
For whatever lies ahead, we're always there. Auto Owners Insurance.
For your no-obligation quote, please call Choice Insurance at 734-641-4200. Is it time to refresh your office or workspace? Office Express believes in supporting the people who bring your business to life and in helping you efficiently reach your goals. They do this by providing creative workplace solutions and tools. They're everything office, including office supplies, furniture, and printed products. Stop by their state-of-the-art furniture showroom or call 877-795-2600 to begin your journey to a more efficient business. This message is sponsored by Office Express OEX, a proud supporter of local Catholic charities.
Ever thought you'd make a bungle by trading in or selling your used vehicle only to find out it's worth a dinner for two? Well, it's much more valuable to donate your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Thousands of Americans donate their vehicle each year. The donation to Ave Maria is easy, tax deductible, and supports our efforts to evangelize. A year from now, will you remember that dinner or your gracious and selfless donation? Go to AveMariaRadio.net to find out more. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at AveMariaRadio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
The Midwest Independent Retailers Foundation is proud to partner with Ave Maria Radio for a 39th annual High Five Turkey Drive. We want to provide turkeys to 6,000 families, and we need your help. For every $20 donated by an Ave Maria Radio listener, we'll match it with another $20 and buy more turkeys. Call today, 800-666-6233, and donate to the High Five Turkey Drive. That's 800-666-6233. Help give a Thanksgiving dinner to another family.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. Pope Francis reminds us that it does not take a specialized degree in theology to become a great evangelist. We're all called to evangelize. Think about the woman at the well. After she encountered Jesus, she immediately went into the city and invited others to meet him as she had. You and I can go out now and do the same. And St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. Get involved today by contacting us at streetevangelization.com.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. The rise of suicide, especially in our young people, has become epidemic. My guest, Teresa Anthony, has experienced the grief of losing a loved one to suicide with her son Matthew, who suffered from depression and alcoholism and died by suicide at the age of 25. Teresa is a freelance writer and specializes in the field of addiction, mental health, and dual diagnosis recovery. She is the author of My 13th Station. A mother shares her son's tragic battle with depression, alcoholism, and demons. Teresa, good to have you with me. Thanks.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Let's, if you don't mind, give us just a thumbnail sketch of the story, would you please? And then we'll get sure. Some of the details.
Sure, yes. So, as you told your listeners there, I did lose my son to suicide about 6 years ago. It's quite an interesting story because he showed no signs of any problems whatsoever until he was almost 19 years old. He was just a really normal, well-adjusted, wonderful son. And then things changed very rapidly at about that point of his life. And then for the next 6 years, he really struggled so much with first depression and then anxiety. And then he used alcohol to self-medicate while he was in college. and then became chemically dependent on alcohol, which, you know, is devastating.
Right.
And so then his life just unraveled, and I decided that I wanted to share this story with people who may, A, be going through this with their own child, and I can offer some kind of helpful information and tips about, you know, signs of despair and think mistakes that I made in dealing with someone with addiction, because when you're in the thick of it, it's very destabilizing.
Yes.
And so you do, I did make some mistakes, you know, but I decided to be very transparent in sharing my story so that other people could learn about it. But also, there's a very important sub-story here. On our street, including my home and neighbors' homes, we experienced paranormal activity. We, as a result of this, we learned eventually the source of it was there was a woman practicing witchcraft. we had a huge level of emotional discord going on in this area of the neighborhood where it resulted in immediate, a sudden onset of addiction and mental health issues. We had 3 suicides and 2 additional suicide attempts within this string of homes on my street of 16 homes.
Oh, mercy. That's an incredible number of suicides and attempts
yes.
in such a small group, 16
yes.
homes. When did you first see signs that your son was having difficulty? Because for 19 years, you didn't see any significant problem there.
None at all. Basically, he was a stellar athlete. He was a baseball player. He hung out with fellow players. He had wonderful friends. We loved his friends. They didn't get in trouble. There was nothing like that all through his childhood and high school years. And first I have to say to the audience that, my goodness, I am not ignoring the fact that the majority of mental health issues and addiction that can come as a co-occurring disorder happen due to very organic, natural reasons,
right.
meaning biology, family history, chemistry,
sure.
environmental, all of that is valid. But I am just saying that in a certain percentage of people who have afflictions like this, there is a spiritual warfare element going on here. We can't deny that Satan is out there seeking the ruin of souls, and I believe our young adults are right there in the crosshairs, you know. So my son was normal as can be, and then there was a foothold, which means an opening that we all can give the devil, his little demons. We can expose ourselves. We can expose ourselves to things that are very bad for us, and unfortunately they're normalized in our culture. But these are things like violence in movies and video games and darkness. Music was the problem for my son, the music that he chose.
Sure.
But pornography is another tool of the devil that luring so many young people into that trap. So what happens is when they lay out a welcome mat for the devil enters the mind. And I'm not talking about, you know, possession. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about oppression. They become oppressed in their mind through the habitual sin. And so for my son, it was the music. He became very enamored with this horrible genre of music called death metal, and
uh-huh.
I don't know if you've heard it.
Yes, I have. Mm-hmm.
It sounds like demons screaming, and, you know, it's all centered around the mark of the beast and demonic. Everything's demonic, and that's one of my regrets, and I mentioned that in the book, that I wasn't as proactive then as I should have been to get him in front of a priest. I tried to handle that at home. I didn't have the support of my husband, and so that was the beginning, but it morphed into the black metal, which is, it's literally, Al, it's not music at all. It sounds as if you're listening to demons screaming at the top of their lungs the most hateful, horrible, awful things. And I told him it was not allowed in the house, that it was bad for him, it could hurt his soul. And, of course, at 18 and a half, he ignored his mom. He goes off to school and, at the same time, stopped going to Mass, you see. And so it was shortly after that his first symptoms, which began with insomnia, started kicking in. And then the depression, by the fall of his freshman year, the depression kicked in very badly. And then before we knew it, he was drinking with all the kids in at school. So from then on, you know, it was just a tragedy.
Wow. When do you first become aware that you're dealing with spiritual warfare here?
So we started noticing the first sign of something weird happened 2 years in, so 94, and I witnessed this myself. We had a next-door neighbor who, she was just a very off-putting personality, so we just kept our distance.
Sure.
Well, one day, our kids, my son and his buddies, they were all 6 years old, we're playing ball. Well, the ball rolled onto her lawn, and it upset her. She's yelling at this little boy, Jesse. Anyway, they leave and go up the street, and apparently the little boy went in and talked to his mother about it. And then a few minutes later, and I hear some more loud sounds, and I see the little boy's mother on the driveway of this neighbor lady, and they are yelling at each other. And the mother is giving the lady, you know, a warning, don't you ever speak to my son like that again.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And she threw a few choice words at this awful woman who lived next door to me. And I kind of thought, yay, you know, someone needs to say something to this woman, right? Well, Al, you won't believe it, but within a couple months, that mother had committed suicide.
Oh.
So at first, we didn't make a connection at all. You
sure.
know, it wasn't so much later that we started experiencing things in the house. We started noticing strange smells. It was early when we were getting ready for, you know, school and work. Everybody's up early, about 6 a.m., and we're smelling this burning smell. And at first, we didn't know where is it coming from. So we eventually figured out it was coming from that woman's backyard, our next-door neighbor, that lady. Then our neighbors on the opposite side of this house, of that lady's house, also smelled the smells. And we would confer with each other, what is she burning back there, you know? Okay, so that was the first little sign of something odd going on at the lady's house in the backyard. We would come home, and I'd get to the top of the stairs and was met with this terrible odor that seemed to be coming from behind the wall at the top of the landing, and it smelled like a dead rat or a dead animal, something
sure.
decomposing, right? And when I first smelled it the first time, I thought, oh, how gross. There's a rat stuck behind the wall, and it's dead, and, you know, just the thought of it. And then I just, you know, kept unpacking the car, and I got distracted and didn't think about it, and so that happened. Well, my gosh, again, it happened two more times that year.
Did you locate it?
Well, so here's the deal, Al. The second time I thought, well, what are the chances that this would happen at the same place, the animal dying in the same spot?
Right.
And then the third time is when it finally occurred to me that as soon as we came home, you know, we would smell it, all of us smelled it, and then it would immediately disappear. And it wasn't till the third time I went, wait a minute, as soon as we get in the house and we're in the house, it disappears.
Hmm.
If it's a dead rat, you know,
right,
gosh, that
right.
smell lasts 3 days and you can't even walk by the zone, you know. When our neighbors, when we started comparing notes, we started thinking we could handle this through our own efforts, right? So I went through my house with holy water. I had the Bible in my hand. I went through, nobody was home, and I went through every room with this holy water and, you know, in a very loud, firm voice, casting the demon out of my house. I get every window, every doorway, every corner, and I did the whole house like this to hopefully cleanse my house, right?
I was going to ask you, did your local priest, was he aware of what you were going through?
Yes, he became aware, not until things got really, really, really awful, where my son was in serious distress and things were happening. But it was so bad that I reached out to our parish, our pastor. He got back to me, and he said, asked a few more questions, and he said he would meet me at my house that following Sunday. And so we met, and he brought with him a woman who assists him when he has to do exorcisms in the house, like not of people, but the home, because she had a particular sensitivity that she could help in that respect. And where he didn't, he said, I don't have that. I'm here to do the ritual. But so it was really, it was quite an amazing experience.
Yeah. Was your son participating in these events with you?
No, okay. He was not. And so he was then living at this point when the house was exercised. He was living in Colorado at that point.
Okay.
So it was just my daughters and I at that point.
How did he understand the difficulty he was going through? How would he have described it to
oh,
us?
Oh, boy. You know what? I'm so glad you asked me that, because I've got to tell you, one of the, I think, most poignant aspects of this book, I found, after he died, I found his worksheets from his rehab,
yes.
He's sent at rehab, where they meet with a therapist, and then they do these little exercises.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I found the worksheets that he had kept. And, oh, my goodness, it will break your heart. It will break your heart, because it really allows a glimpse into how the person, the afflicted person, feels about themselves and what they are going through. He didn't understand, I don't believe, at the time, that he was putting it together at all, that he was under attack, you know, that he had something attached to him. I don't think so. And at that time, you know, I wasn't 100% sure at that time. It all unfolded, you know.
Right.
But at that time, he was just dealing with the overt afflictions, which were depression and alcoholism. And oh, my goodness, to read in his own penmanship how he felt about himself and the shame he felt and fear and, oh, my goodness. And so I feel that that is a really important part of the book, because I think we tend to, there's a stigma, you know, there's a stigma, and that stigma is preventing people from getting help, right? Like these kids who are so despairing that they're committing suicide, right? I mean, if we were more open and understanding that these are human beings, these are souls, you know, children of God, who are hurting and they need help, whether it's psychotherapy or whether it's spiritual help or both combinations, whatever their needs are, we need to address it openly and offer them support.
Mm. Well, I'll tell you, we just, again, as you pointed out, there's a lot more here in the book to this story. We just scratched the surface of today, but I thank you for taking the time with me, Teresa, and we'll talk again in the future. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
The book is called My 13th Station, Teresa Anthony, the author. I'm Al Cresta.
Do you have a problem with the IRS? The staff at Compesca Tax Advisors are listeners and proud supporters of Ave Maria Radio. They would like to relieve the burden from your shoulders of dealing with the IRS. They'll also donate 10% of their fee to a pro-life charity if you mention this ad when you call. Don't deal with the IRS on your own. Call Compesca Tax Advisors at 800-351-3588 today and sleep better tonight. Stop the IRS freight train by calling 800-351-3588 today.
Hi, I'm Dr. Stan Williams, and this is Facts for Christianity. How can we trust the accuracy of the gospel stories when they were not written down for 30 to 60 years after the events occurred? The answer, in short, is oral tradition. But that sounds so unreliable. We all know how distorted things get when people today share stories by word of mouth. Yet, in the first century, things were much different. Because illiteracy was so high, society then implemented safeguards like strict memorization. It's reported that Rabbi Perdita used to repeat every passage 400 times for a dull pupil, and once, for an especially dull one, repeated it 400 times more. From time immemorial, teachers in the Near East have practiced this kind of technique, repetition. And that's a fact for Christianity. To explore more, go to AveMariaRadio.net. Under Resources, look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
Do you have a mid to large size business and are looking for a full service marketing and advertising company? Geektown USA is making the challenging world of digital much simpler to understand. It's always good to have a geek on your side, so let us help you with your branding, website, and digital marketing. Visit geektownusa.com, and when you contact us, mention Avi Maria Radio. Geektown USA, where creative marketing meets smart technology. Visit geektownusa.com today.
Well, thanks so much. It's been good being with you this first hour. Let me remind you that what we discuss on this program, we try to follow up on either in the online bookstore or in the Cresta Guest Archives. So Teresa Anthony's book available in our online bookstore. Also, we'll have books there on St. Elizabeth Trinity. And we'll have follow-up information on the Mass of the Americas if you go to the Cresta Guest Archives. So again, just head on over to AveMariaRadio.net and stay tuned. We'll be together again the next hour.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.